I picked a topic that was somewhat related to Mother's Day, although it's a little, not exactly Mother's Day topic, but it's somewhat, the way I remembered it when I first chose it, I was like, oh, this fits very closely. Yeah, well, as I had remembered, as I kept reading the chew, I was like, yeah, this isn't really a Mother's Day chew, but okay, it's an interesting topic in of itself. So the topic we're going to talk about today is in vitro fertilization, or IVF. Which, just as a background, if you're not fully familiar with it, in vitro fertilization involves the collection of a donor, usually the husband's sperm. Depending on the situation, sometimes it's also he doesn't actually, and the donor sperm is then inserted directly into a woman's uterus, or really into her fallopian tubes. And in that way, there is a better chance of...
Well, that's actually IUI.
That's IUI. It's, so that's IUI, yeah.
IVF,
of course...
They take the eggs out of the woman, and they do it in a petri dish, and then they insert
it back. Yeah, so then they insert it back, yeah. So then IVF is where they take the eggs. Also, they have them fertilized, and then only then they implant them into a woman's uterus. So it's a little bit further ahead.
Or they implant it into a surrogate.
Or they implant it into a surrogate. That could happen also. So all of those are really interesting questions because, halakhically, there's a bunch of questions that come up with this which relate to a whole host of issues. A few issues that Ramosha talks about specifically that we're going to deal with is how do we treat IVF, both in terms of in terms of the husband-wife relationship, is this considered to be a sexual act of some sort? Is it not considered to be a sexual act? Is this, how do we relate to it? So this might have effects where we're going to talk about NIDA, right? What if the woman's in NIDA currently, right? Is that going to be problematic to have IVF? We'll talk about, are you fulfilling mitzvah of puru revu at the same time, right? Is the man fulfilling his mitzvah of puru revu because he's, not directly...
Well, you think so, it's his sperm.
Well, he's not, but he's not involved the same way. So, there's a lot to talk about in that sense. Is it better to use, if you have to use someone else's sperm, like a donor sperm, is it better to use a Jew or a non-Jew or a sibling? Like, what's the best type of, person, the donor to use in that situation? So, a lot of different questions that come up. Ariot issues, and there are a lot of really interesting halakhic questions. Of course, this is a very sensitive, personal topic, because it's, people are trying to have a child, so it's very personal, but it's, it's an interesting topic just halakhically in terms of defining parenthood and who is a parent and what IVF exactly does as a relationship.
Is there any difference, as you say, it's a very personal thing, is there any difference if it's the attempt to have a first child or subsequent, if you had the first child naturally, with no help or anything, is there any difference if you're going for a second or third or whatever?
In terms of like the halacha or in terms of?
Say,
it definitely happens. I mean,
girl, and you already got say puru revu.
Well, more common than boy and girl, there are people who have like secondary infertility. Is a phenomenon that happens. People are not always aware of it, which means that you had, an easier time having your first child, but now your second child, for whatever reason, you're not really having your second child. You're having infertility issues with the second child. So that is possible, even though, I had the first child, there should be no issues. No, for some reason it does happen. There could be secondary fertility or tertiary fertility. You could have problems later, so it does happen. And, if you want to have two children, then there definitely is grounds or a reason to have.
But let's say you already have two, and one's a boy and one's a girl. Then is an issue.
To use IVF?
To have a third one.
It's a bit of a shaila, but Ramosh doesn't deal with this here. I think most poskim think it's okay. Because it's still to have more children, so it's not, I don't think there's really so many issues.
The thing is, now you could do a whole lot more than when he wrote.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so what interests me here is less the questions of the science. He does actually have parts describing it, and I kind of skipped it out because it's kind of like the science has changed a bit in the last 40 plus years. But what interests me more is kind of the question of yichus, of how do we relate to the biological parentage of this child? How do we relate to this act, like in terms of peru, things of that sort? So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today. And their motion has a pretty interesting or important position, actually, on this issue, especially, we'll see, in relationship to some other posting who very strongly disagreed with him. So the first tshuva was a tshuva that was written in Tafshin Chaf Aleph, so it's about 1961. It's written to Rabbi Yaakov Cohen Zeltzer, who is from Adat Yishurun of Johannesburg. So corresponding with someone from Johannesburg. So it's as follows. Hinei b'davar ha'isha asher lefi divrei harofim mumchim hi mukhsharet lekabel hirayon rak b'yom ha'shmini v'yom ha'tshiim et chalat ha'vesta. So the question that he's raising, addressing here, is a question of what's called halachic infertility, which refers to a woman whose ovulation period is during a time where consistently she is tmeya for nida during the same time. Meaning, I'll expand a little bit what I mean by this. Nowadays, we treat every woman who has a nida as effectively what's called a zava, which means that a woman actually has to, not only does she have to stop menstruating, she has to stop seeing any blood, and only then can she count 7 clean days. Which means that the average woman, their period of nida is usually around 12 days or so. There are other reasons also because of 12. But it's around 12 days, which is a lot longer than the 7 days that the Torah seems to mandate for nida. So sometimes we have what's called halachic infertility, which is that for some women, they begin to, their ovulation period, like the key period for when they can have, you know, when the egg can be fertilized and when the egg is released, can happen on day 8 or day 9, which would be fine in terms of hilchos nida, but because we have this halacha that we treat nida as a zava, so because we're having this rabbinic decree, all of a sudden, they're not going to be able to, you know, to conceive of a child during this time period because she's forbidden to her husband at this time period. So you have what's called halachic infertility. They can't have a child.
I knew people in the shul, more than one, that psak that allowed them to just follow the helpless nidas because the woman was not really a zava, and that allowed them to be able to have tashmish at a time when the woman could get pregnant.
So that's really interesting. Actually, let's read, if you want to read Rav Moshe. Yeah, actually, Rav Moshe says that. So the guy who asked him the question actually suggested that. Because of the Torato, Shebedavar Zulifat Azera Lebar Lebidda, Yesh Materian Achare Avor Yud Zayin Nikiim, Kodem Aveset, Vetetze Misapek Zava, Ve'achar Zayin Yami, Metchal Aveset, Im Kisok Midemea, Tidbo, Kitinida Midoraita. So he's actually dealing, he actually makes a different suggestion. He actually suggests to use IUI, but only after, you know, on day 8, after she has had 17 clean days before she menstruated, which, to basically explain in very shorthand, if in theory we don't, part of the problem of Nida and Zava is we don't always know who's a Zava, because it's very complicated in terms of figuring out from back then what it meant to be Zava nowadays, but if there is a long period of time, 17 days, between menstruations, then presumably the next time a woman menstruates is not going to be Zava, it's going to be Anida, for at least according to most Rishonim, not according to Rambam, but according to most Rishonim. And therefore, his suggestion is that way we solve the problem according to most Rishonim, and that way there's no issue of, and that way there's no issue in that you could, a woman, even according to Adam, would be able to go to the mikvah, that's the case you're referring to. Here, the suggestion was not they're going to the mikvah, but you'd be able to IUI, and there would be a problem of Nida in the same way. So, that's the suggestion he has. So this, because this person, there are people who disagree, he wanted to know my opinion on this issue. So Rav Moshe says as follows. So if the question here is a question of to have, you know, sexual relations, that they're going to, you know, conceive of a child in the typical way, and they're going to, instead of waiting the rabbinic decree of 7 clean days, they're going to instead just only use 7 total days from when she began to menstruate. So Moshe says, I don't feel comfortable being matir this, for the woman to actually go to the mikvah before she has waited her, you know, 12 mandatory days. I don't feel comfortable with that. And if such a question would appear to me, then I would discuss it, you know, maybe orally, but I wouldn't feel comfortable writing it down for posterity, right? I don't feel like this is something I want to disseminate, but I do feel like, you know, if this came up, so let's talk about it, and maybe, you know, his talk will be a bit different.
It seems to me that makes sense, because in each individual case, you have to find out whether the woman is really a zubba or not. And so you can't really, I mean, you can make a general assumption if she's not a zubba, but...
Right, well, the case is you can find out based on, you know, Ramosha is going to ask the same questions that the tshuva is going to ask. I think part of Ramosha thinks he doesn't want to, he doesn't really want to create, he doesn't really feel comfortable making a precedent.
Right.
For this. I
feel like he might want to consider how long they've been trying to have a kid.
Yeah. I think the alternative questions, yeah, I think there are a lot of, like, side questions that Ramosha would consider in terms of whether he could rely on, like, more makeo positions that he wouldn't feel comfortable writing about in a tshuva. But it's interesting, a reason I quoted that beginning was because I thought it was an interesting place where you see Ramosha, on the one hand, is not saying it's, like, he's not totally knocking it out, but he's also saying I'm clearly not comfortable with this, you know, in a vacuum. I will say before I get to, I'll just say with regard to this halachic infertility question, just two side things. Number one, not everyone agreed with Ramosha here. There are post-game who explicitly wrote they were matir, this type of situation. I'm happy to discuss those type of post-game, but there are a few post-game who did explicitly write it. Nowadays, at the same time, it's very uncommon because not only can you use IVF, but it's also, even if you don't use IVF, there are fairly easy medications you can do to be able to delay ovulation so that doesn't become an issue of halachic infertility. So it's very rare to need to rely on these type of kulas. Usually we can solve this issue.
If a woman doesn't feel comfortable with, or as far as a couple, with using medication to change, like, that seems a little bit extreme. Like, yes, you could take these measures.
I think it's pretty standard. Like, I think if, like, you ask, like, doctors, it's not so weird.
I don't know anything about this.
Like, you just add, like, you just take, like, progesterone. It's like you just take progesterone. It's not, like, harmful. I mean, you can ask, like, your, you know, if this ever comes up, people can ask their OBGYN and, like, find out. But I'm pretty sure it's, like, not considered to be a atypical medical treatment to just take some progesterone. Like, it happens for medical reasons. If you're not Jewish, for other, you know, also happens.
It's interesting that you would prefer them to have IUI than for the man to actually have sex with a woman if she's not a zava within the...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Ramosha, certainly.
Very interesting to me. That would imply to me, anyway, we haven't got to it yet, obviously, but you would think that still makes the father, et cetera.
We'll get there, yeah. Yeah, so it's actually interesting. Ramosha certainly does not. We'll talk about it at the end. So that's regard to halachic infertility. But the question that, you know, the meat of the question is really about what do we do about IVF? How do we treat this type of child, this type of conception? So he's actually talking about, it's actually not clear if he's talking about IVF or really IUI. But a situation where the semen is inserted through a tube into the woman's, her uterus, in case of stomach here, but uterus. So the question he wants to deal with, she's a nida, right? She hasn't gone to the mikvah, so even if they say biblically, she's still a nida. But can you do this? Because there's usually a prohibition of, there's a prohibition of, it's her karet, of having sexual relations with a nida. So that's the question here. So can you do it or not? So some people can actually felt very uncomfortable. This is why this guy thought we have to do IUI, but only relying on the fact that she first goes to the mikvah after relying on the biblical 7 days. Because he didn't feel comfortable, you know, with IUI beforehand. So Ramosha is dealing with the question and says he doesn't think there's an issue at all of IUI in this situation. Why not? He iser v'karik de nida hu ras al yedei tashmish debiya, because the entire prohibition of nida is specifically one that requires sexual relations. If you're not going to have sexual intercourse, then it's not a problem of nida. Just because, you know, there's semen and there's egg. That doesn't change anything. The biology doesn't change anything unless you actually have the sexual act taking place. And so there's a case that the Gemara uses and that the Rishonim use as kind of the model that they talk about this type of sugya. And it's actually one of those really interesting Gemaras where you wonder, is this ever possible to happen? Like in the Gemara, like it seems like really unlikely, But somehow, like, tomorrow's topic actually is incredibly relevant to nowadays. And the topic is what's called the topic of Zerabambati, which is, can a woman become pregnant from taking a bath where semen is present in the bathwater?
They apparently thought so in the Gemara, at least from the one I learned.
But
it seems to me to be virtually impossible.
As far as I know, it's like, I think the probability of it is like incredibly, like, it's like very close to zero. So they certainly were concerned about it, even though it's an interesting question. But certainly the relevance to it is it's almost the exact same case. Because you have a case where there is, you know, semen floating around in the bathtub, which is the equivalent of, like, in a medical tube, in a, you know, and it's inserted without any, you know, sexual act. And so you have a very similar question. And so the Gemara, their discussion, and the Gemara there explicitly says that in such a situation, in shum pagam al aflad, the child has no defects in his yichus. He's not considered to be a mom's there.
If the woman is married, the child's not a mom's.
That's what the Gemara seems to suggest.
Not the product of an
illicit relation, yes. Because you need to have specifically a sexual act, which is an illicit act, and be able to create a mom's there. We'll go through this a little more. And not only that, umifurash kin bataz, so there's a second case that the taz actually quotes in Yoredeah, Megot smak b'shim Rabbeinu Peretz. So there's a rishon that actually talks about, not a case of a bathtub, but what about the case of sheets? Can a woman sit or lie on sheets, which in this case he's talking about a case where her husband's sheets, does she have to be concerned that maybe her husband's semen is present and she'll become pregnant while she's a nida? Right? Probably also incredibly unlikely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know which is more like unlikely, the bathtub or this. I think they're both pretty unlikely. But that's the question they're being prepared to deal with. And his answer is, V'ein choshesh penti d'ber mishuvah chadash shabala, v'yavlad ben anida, mishum d'kevon in kan v'yad iser, havlad kasher l'gamrei. So the answer being apparent suggests, and quoted by the Taz, and quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, is that we are not concerned with this being an issue. Not because it might not happen, which is probably the main answer, it's like this is incredibly rare, this wouldn't happen, but more to the point, because even if it were to happen, it wouldn't be a problem, because the child would not be considered called Bet Hanida. It's not a child of an illicit relation. Instead, it's actually, you know, it's a child born fine, because there's no actual sexual act taking place here. And so, while the cases of the bathtub and the case of the sheet are certainly, you know, a little bit more far-fetched, what's really interesting is that these cases are incredibly relevant to modern medicine with IVF and IUI. That's incredibly relevant. The only potential concern that Rav Moshe mentioned, that the Gemara does mention, v'rak she'al she'fadar shel acher kavdinan ahavchana v'al shema yisa achoto me'aviv she'zeleka b'nida mishifatar shel bala. There is one concern that the Gemara seems to suggest, and the Rishon seems to suggest, about using this type of method of conception. And the concern is what's called the concern of havchana, that maybe this child is going to be a product of a man and a woman, and people are not necessarily going to know who the parentage is. They're not going to necessarily know who the man was. And why are we so concerned about you don't know who the man is? Because maybe this child is going to grow up, and because they don't know who their father is, maybe they're going to end up marrying their sister.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly you can watch like 15 Hollywood movies where like something similar-ish happens of some sort.
Is there any concern about him like potentially being a Kohen, but exactly a lady?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Not taking that in the tshuva. I'm going to put that out. Different tshuva, we'll talk about that in a second, about Kohen.
Okay.
But either way, when it comes to, so the real concern about, there is one concern when it comes to, the service conception, which is a question of Havchana, which we'll get to in a second, because it's actually Havchana, which means identifying the parentage, knowing who the father is, which we'll get to, because it's really interesting why it's a relevant concern. We'll get to in a second, why I think it's such an interesting position. But either way, your Moshe says that's the only real concern. And therefore, in a case that we're dealing with, which is a case where the sperm donor is not some random person, but the sperm donor is the woman's husband, we don't really have that concern because no one's going to, you know, think otherwise. In fact, actually, you know, IUI IVF takes place a lot more frequently than people realize. You know, I personally know of a number of people in this shul who've had children through IVF or IUI, and you wouldn't know the difference unless you were involved in, like, the question. Yeah, it's like you wouldn't know otherwise. So it's you know, in that sense, like, there really would be no problem of havchana of identifying the parentage in that situation. And the Rosh
Hashanah identify just in terms of DNA.
Nowadays, you can also identify through DNA, but the question, certainly this was not true in Moshe's time. Nowadays, you are right. You could do that. The question is, does everyone do it, though? Not everyone necessarily goes through and knows to take, you know, what's it called, like 21andMe?
But if they don't know, if they're not that informed, they probably don't know about Halacha or don't care about Halacha.
Yeah, I think most people just don't know even to ask. Like, they might assume if you have, you know, I don't know if you're always necessarily going to check, you know, I've never done a DNA test. Like, I think most of us haven't done a DNA test, even if, you know.
In certain cases, in Israel, it's required.
DNA tests.
Before they get married, or?
No. If you use IVF, and if you use a surrogate.
Right, so that makes,
if their children are going to get married, then they have to do DNA tests? Or?
Well, I think if you want to just make sure there's no, like, malpractice. They want to make sure that, like, the...
No. It's just a question of... establishing, you know, as you said, you know, who the parents are.
Yeah, they want to make sure that it's, like, the right egg, right donor. Yeah.
More so, for sure, you need it for surrogacy. And, you know, to establish citizenship. And if there's a surrogate involved, you need to do a conversion, even if both parents are Jewish.
Well, if the surrogate's not Jewish.
Pardon?
If the surrogate's not Jewish.
Right. So we're going to talk about, so conversion actually doesn't deal with, conversion is also a really interesting also case about whether or not that's relevant. So these are all the really, you know, interesting cases, like all of these rules, like who is the parent, like is the father considered to be father with regard to Peruvu? Does the father need to be father with regard to being a Kohen? What's the relationship between the surrogate mother and the birth mother, or the biological mother? Right. All these questions are really interesting in terms of, like, a whole sort of halachic concerns. So Moshe doesn't deal with all of these here, but the question he's dealing with, first question here, is the question of Nida. And he's pretty clear. He said there really is no issue of Nida because there's no problem in this moment. And therefore, he says, I'm skipping a little bit.
One question.
Yeah.
Sorry, if they had relations and they knew that the woman was a Nida, is the child considered a Mamzer?
The child's not a Mamzer. What's called the Ben Nida, which the Gemara says is, like, there's, like, some issue with a Ben Nida, but it's not a Mamzer. Mamzer has to be the product of a forbidden relationship,
right, like,
which is not Nida. And Nida is the one exception.
So he's not even talking about, so when he's talking about, like, what's the issue with the child, is that he'll be a Ben Nida, which we don't even know what the implications are.
Yeah, well, but there's, like, the Gemara certainly, like, talked about, yeah, it's not clear exactly what the, yeah.
Sorry,
it's
about 90% of the Jewish children born in America are probably Ben Nida.
Yeah, potentially, yeah.
Yeah, but in the conservative world, Nida is one of the few things people are actually strict about.
Not so much anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There's, like, interesting questions on, like, can you consider maybe that a woman take a bath in the meantime? That would work if, like, you have it. There are all sorts of, like, interesting questions you can ask. It's an interesting question to deal with in terms of sociology. But either way, Moshe says when it comes to this case, there is no issue. And I'm skipping a little bit. And Rav Moshe adds, not only this, but once I am being matir that IUI or IVF is permitted and there's no problem potentially of Nida or anything of the like, so then not only is it going to be permitted, but I actually will discourage a woman to go to the mikvah early. Right, I don't think you should rely on this kula of, oh, maybe she's only biblically a Nida and she never should go to the mikvah, you know, after 7 days instead of after 12 days. She shouldn't do that because there's no reason to use that kula. Because if anything, the kula might just lead to potential avera because, you know, we're not necessarily concerned with every couple, but maybe if a woman goes to the mikvah early, maybe she'll use that opportunity not only for, you know, IUI or IVF, but maybe they'll end up having, you know, sexual relations with her husband, which would then be, you know, I guess, biblically permitted, but at least rabbinically be problematic. So it's just it'd be a kula of some sort, which would really lead to unnecessary potential problems. So it's easier to, once you don't need it, no reason to permit it. That's kind of Moshe's position on the issue. And Moshe adds not only that, but especially true that, to Elisa's question, the entire question here is a question of ben nida, pegam nida, which itself is not entirely clear what exactly, how bad really the product of a nida is, since it doesn't affect any Isuri Karet. It's not really prohibitions in terms of the child status. The child can even be a Kohen. And so the only real pegam he mentions is a question of like chashivut and like maila, which is like not really clear what that means. Like it's societal, like
right, like
changes.
It's supposed to become public.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear exactly what it means. It's like very, it's a little bit esoteric what that means. I mean, it's, yeah.
He was just trying to discourage people from doing it, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like, it is important to keep in mind.
No, it certainly is a position. It's just hard to know exactly what Benida, you know, really, really means. But, yeah. Okay, then the next paragraph, he deals with the really interesting question of Pururvu. Okay, so now that you're doing the IUI, you're doing IVF, and, you know, either, you know, earlier, before 12 days, or even after 12 days, whatever the situation, you want to deal with the really interesting question of, what have the couple fulfilled the mitzvah of Pururvu? So the next paragraph begins as follows. So the way that the science works is you insert this is IUI, you insert the semen through a tube, into the woman's uterus in the moments while she is fertile, during ovulation. So according to some divisions, here's a question he wants to deal with, are you yotze the mitzvah of Pruvu? So Moshe has the following analysis. Number one, the man, So one position quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, Beit Shmuel is one of the main commentaries on Shulchan Aruch and Eben Ezer, so it's explicitly commenting on this case of the bathtub, that even in the bathtub case, the father will also fill the mitzvah of Pruvu. So according to that position, definitely you'll fulfill the mitzvah Pruvu, even in the case in IUI. Right?
So,
yeah. Especially since, yeah. But he says, even though the Taz quotes the position who disagrees, which is the Chacham Tzvi disagrees, thinks that the bathtub would not be a valid way of fulfilling mitzvah Pruvu. The Chol HaShinichta B'Taz, who shame him, yet the Zarash, and Batim is Stapek, Mishum Detali Bekum Vase, Dehin is Abra Me'atzma. Now we must never show the bekan they will see bechavana adar lachnis v'shel lepes and ishto dehavei zeh maaseh. So Moshe argues, even in that case, there's a big difference between that case and this case. Even according to you, we disagree that the case of, you know, impregnation through, you know, semen which is found floating in a bath, that's very different from a case of IUI. Because in the bath case, there's no intentionality on the part of, you know, the husband or the wife, for that matter, right? It's entirely accidental, and there's no sexual act at all. There's nothing replacing it. As opposed to with IUI or IVF, the entire process is very much, you know, intentional, right? There's something intentional about a process from start to finish. So a couple, because they're involved in it, you can kind of attribute it to their mitzvah in a way that you can't do it with the bathtub case. And so Moshe argues, even the Chacham Tzvi, who disagreed with the bathtub case, maybe he would agree that it would work for Pruvu when it came to something more deliberate like IUI or IVF.
The Chacham Tzvi saying that you're Yotze Pruvu if the husband wasn't the guy who left the semen in the bath. He's clearly not...
You mean the Shvei Shmuel.
Yeah. So because he's in no way the biological father.
He's talking about a case where it is biological.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, yeah. In a case where it was the husband.
Oh, because I always got the impression from the Gemara, some woman went to a bath and there had been a man in the bath. And
yeah, yeah,
that's
also the case. Yeah.
You know,
yeah, the Beit Shmuel is talking about a case of even where it was the husband. Is he Yotzei Peruvu? And he says, yes, you would be Yotzei Peruvu. Well, the Chacham Tzvi disagrees. He thinks you wouldn't be Yotzei Peruvu. And her motion says it's only because there was no intentionality. If there was intentionality, then he would agree. I'm not sure it's so true. It's possible the Chacham Tzvi would say no. As long as you don't have, you know, a sexual act, it's possible that, you know, maybe you're not the opposite, Mr. Peruvu. Maybe, you know.
I think there's a lot of people who have sexual relations that don't have the intention to have a baby at the time they're having a sexual relationship.
Yeah, that's very
baby.
Different.
They have a baby anyway, and they're called Yotzei Peruvu.
Yeah, but that's not, but that's, but there you're, there's a question of, you know, are you thinking that this is going to lead to having a baby?
Right,
but you're,
no, it could.
But you're definitely intending to have, you know, sexual relations at this moment. That's the question. Like, are you when you know when the husband ejaculates the sperm? At that moment, are they intending for that to be used in some process of sex? Is that part of the? Is that intentional? That's kind of the question here. To be explicit. So that's kind of a Ramosha's statement that even that other position, the Beit Shmuel would even the Chacham Tzvi would agree in this case. I'll point out that not everyone agrees with that. That there could be that you need for Peruvu, you need to actually have a sexual act. Otherwise, it's not sufficient to be Yossi Peruvu. Then you'll say, oh, but how are you possibly fulfill Peruvu? The answer is you're not. And that, you know, unfortunately, some people can't fulfill every mitzvah. You know, it's just that's the reality. It's, you know, unfortunately, God commanded us 613 mitzvot, but sometimes we're physically impaired and we can't. And it's considered onus. Like, you're not responsible for fulfilling mitzvot you can't fulfill.
Right, like a Kohen who has a physical deformity can't serve in the
bigger mitzvah. And we're not going to say the Kohen did something wrong. He didn't. He can't fulfill the mitzvot of being serving a big mikdash, but he did something wrong with what he did. He simply just has no alternatives. So this would be similar according to those positions. But Moshe disagrees. He thinks he really would be Yotzei Peruvu. And he tries proving this by the following proof. Ube'etzem tama megibeta, the kevon shelo b'masa epshel lo yasa, lo nachon. Not only that, not only do I think that maybe the Chacham Tzvi would agree in my case, which is, as I said, a little bit questionable, but furthermore, perhaps more to the point, Moshe thinks that the Chacham Tzvi is wrong. He actually thinks there are a lot of proofs against the Chacham Tzvi. Why? Because whenever we see the concept of Peruvu, it seems that the mitzvah of Peruvu is fulfilled even if, absent this particular condition. Instead, what mitzvah Peruvu seems to be about having children who are Jewish. And how does Moshe prove that? That having Jewish children is mitzvah Peruvu? So the Shulchan Aruch quotes the following case based on the Gemara. What if you are a Gentile, you're not Jewish, and you have children, right? Your children, I say, you know, are also not Jewish. And then the whole family decides to convert at the same time. So are you Yotzei Mitzvah Peruvu? Because you didn't have a child while you were Jewish, right? This happens actually pretty frequently. So are you Yotzei Mitzvah Peruvu? Because you didn't have a child while being Jewish. And so the way that the Shulchan Aruch actually postulates based on the Gemara is, yes, you are fulfilling Mitzvah Peruvu. Even though you, like, the Mitzvah technically is, do, you know, have a sexual act to have a child while you are Jewish, and you didn't do that. And in fact, he quotes Sheikha Azea Turi Evan, so the Turi Evan, who's one of the Achronim on the Gemara, quotes, the Achal Masa Biota Shote Lo Yatsa Vimishtava Terecha Chol Masa Cheret. So some people ask the following question. The Gemara makes it pretty clear. When it comes to, for instance, a mitzvah like Masa, let's say, for instance, you are mentally incapacitated for whatever reason. Like you lost your marbles for some period of time. And you ate matzah during that period, you know, on Pesach.
You
fulfilled the best you can at that moment.
Right.
But then at a later moment, let's say later on that night, all of a sudden, you regain your mental faculties. However that works, you know, you become, you know,
your medication.
Whoever it is, you regain your mental faculties. So it's pretty clear that you have to eat more matzah because he didn't fulfill the mitzvah while you were a shota. So Rav Moshe says, so the Tur Yavin asks, why isn't that the same principle here by the non-Jew convert? Shouldn't you now have to have children because when you did the mitzvah, you weren't Jewish?
But the mitzvah, as you said, is not about the having relations. It's about having those kids who are Jewish.
So that's,
suddenly you have those kids who are Jewish.
So that's Rav Moshe's point. Yeah. So that's this is Rav Moshe's proof to it. Because it's not so intuitive. You would have thought maybe the mitzvah is, you know, the sexual act. But Rav Moshe says, no, this proves to you that actually the mitzvah is not about the sexual act. It's actually about having Jewish children.
What if you're pregnant when you convert?
It's actually an interesting question of what's called there's the Hebrew expression for it. It's
is that the situation? Yeah.
Oh, the family.
Yeah. So usually the child is considered to be converted, like in utero, as part of that process. Yeah. It's actually pretty explicit in the Gemara. In terms of parentage, though, it's not so obvious. For Moshe, I think he would say it's fine. According to those who disagree with Moshe, though, it's not so obvious that the husband, you know, fulfilled Tur Revu to some extent. But, yeah. This is a Moshe's though argument. And therefore, he says, V'ayin v'minchat chinuch, mitzvah aleph, v'minchat chinuch, a different achron, quote in his first treatment, his first mitzvah, mitzvah Tur Revu, shetiris machmazed, mitzvah Tur Revu, einu al hamaseh, that the mitzvah of Puravu is not about the sexual act, rather it's about having children. And that's why, actually, there are a number of corollaries from this. For instance, if, tragically, your children die, are you still fulfilling the mitzvah of Puravu? So, technically, I mean, it's obviously an incredibly incredible tragedy, but technically, according to this position, you actually would not, because you don't have living children anymore. It, you know, unfortunately, it's a clear tragedy. It's something, you know, but it's...
Most people pass in the opposite of that, though.
It's a little bit complicated, yeah. It's,
I mean, you could have children that get killed in a car crash when they're 40 years old, and now all of a sudden you're not Yosef Kuravu.
But as we said, we try to do all the mitzvahs you can in life.
Yeah, sometimes you can't, yeah. I mean, that's why they say also, you know, that's why some posts can say, like, that's why I started to have more than two children. That's why you're fulfilled, you know, you're hedging your bets a little bit. It's, which is obviously a very harsh way of saying it. But, yeah, it's, you know, this is certainly, not everyone agrees with Moshe about this, or Mitzvah Chinuch, but it's worth pointing out. This is certainly a position, and, yeah, as Lisa said, unfortunately, you know, that's the reality of life. You're not always, you know, like, I don't know why it matters to you whether you fulfill the mitzvah in terms of, like, I don't count, you know, my mitzvah in that sense, but technically, on a halachic level, yeah, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah, and if you can have another child, you'd fulfill the mitzvah then. At the same time, on a more positive note, there's a positive corollary of this, which is a question of what if you can't have children? Not from IVF or IUI, what if you just can't have children at all?
You can adopt.
What if you adopt? So this might suggest that there might be halachic value in adopting in terms of Puru Revu. Because if you adopt and you raise a child as Jewish, as your child, then it seems like you fulfill, at least to some extent, mitzvah Puru Revu. So there are actually some positive corollaries.
Only if you adopted a non-Jewish child.
Yeah, but even if you adopt, I think, a Jewish child, definitely if you adopt a non-Jewish child, but even if you adopt a Jewish child, if you raise a Jewish child, if the mitzvah Puru Revu is defined as raising a child to be, you know, Mikhaya mitzvot, Torah mitzvot, so as long as you raise a child, you know, having those values, you fulfilled mitzvah Puru Revu. You know, included them in the, you know, in within the Knesset Yisrael, within the Jewish people.
If they don't keep the mitzvot, so if you are a religious Jew but you have non-religious children, what is that considered?
Oh, but you raised them to be religious, they just turned out not religious, so I would imagine that.
Yeah, I think you still fulfill them. I think the religion thing, you know, it's obviously the ideal. If they're not religious, I think you still technically fulfill it. But I think in terms of adoption, it certainly does raise, you know, a lot of, you know, possibilities. Not everyone agrees with this about adoption. Some people disagree. And then again, if you have, you know, certainly, you know, pastorally, if someone came to me, I would certainly emphasize Rav Moshe's position, not like Ravadi Yosef who disagrees. The alternative is, like, Ravadi, if he's asked the question, if he doesn't think adoption counts as Puru Revu technically, he'll say, yeah, you're just not fulfilling yourself Puru Revu, and you just don't have the ability to do so. That's just the unfortunate reality of, you know, what God gave you. But, I mean, certainly these are hard questions emotionally, but they're really interesting, I think, you know, in terms of the moral, ethical questions of how do we define parentage here. So Rav Moshe says very clearly that you do not need to have a sexual act in order to define as puravu. You don't need to have it either with regard to you do need to have it for hechonida and for isurei karet. Only that is considered to be a problem for isurei karet. That's Rav Moshe's first tshuva on this topic, written in 1961. The second tshuva. Any comments about that tshuva?
I'm surprised that they had IUI in 1961. IVF wasn't developed until after that, I believe.
Yeah, I think he's talking about IUI here. I don't know the history of the development, but yeah. So he got, second tshuva is actually written earlier. It's written in 1959. So he reads to write about a different question about v'din zrika d'zera l'me'eish do shechachu ha'rofim. So a case of IUI. Here's the following question. I'm going to read from the beginning of the next page. But davar mashin ishalti meriayato harbanit hachvoda marachana techiye avor isha achat. So he's asked the following question from a woman, from a rabbanit. Rabbanit here means like a rabbitzin. So he's asked by a rabbitzin, like the somewhat equivalent of a yu'ekset halacha, asked him the following question. Avur ishachat nishbaishah lishol mechvot harato. So she was, a woman was embarrassed, was too embarrassed to ask a man. So this has really interesting connotations about the politics of U.S.S., but I'll leave that aside. But even Rav Moshe concedes that this possibility, I guess, happened even, you know, in 1959. So, in such a case, she needs chartik lashi mishum shartik lachor davar etzel rofim mumchim. So Rav Moshe mentions as an aside that he's taken his time to respond to this question because he wanted to first check with doctors about the scientific reality. Right, Rav Moshe, you know, maybe this was his first time he's really dealing with IUI, and he wanted to know really what's happening. He wanted to know all the details. V'chit shinodati ayidei chonia Rav Agon, Rav Moshe David Tendler, so also he asked by Rav Moshe Tendler certain things, and I'm going to skip the next part because it's not really relevant to us, about different, some of the details about IUI. But here's the question that Rav Moshe is dealing with in this case. The case we get with earlier was a question of IUI from the husband. Here the question is, what if it's not the husband's sperm has a problem of motility, which is often why you need to have IUI, that the sperm is in theory viable, but it's not making it. It's not getting to ovulate, getting to fertilize. What if the sperm is just, it's just not viable. It's just not, you know, the husband is just not able to produce children. That's just the reality of the husband. What if you use a donor, right? Someone else. So can you use a donor for a sperm in order to have children? Which is, it's fairly common, especially among non-Jews, but especially even among Jews, you know, there are women who aren't married, or single, who have IUI, it happens, you know, in the Jewish community, more often people realize. V'din zer acher, so what's the status of this? V'din zer acher, mifurash l'ister, betaz, shevishim rabbein karet, she'isha tzricha li'zaher mishkav ha'sidim, she'chavala ish acher, ten titaber, mishchivat zera shel acher. So the taz, that we quoted earlier, said when it came to sleeping or sitting, for a woman to sit on the sheets of her husband, that we're not concerned with, but he does say that if it came to the sheets of a different man, that we would be concerned with. So we are concerned that maybe a child would be produced from this relationship, from this, you know, from the sheet and the... Yes, it would be a mamzer in theory. So Hari Chazinan from here, Hari Chazinan, she'asur li'ishal yitaber mizera shel acher afilu shelo v'viya shevad kasher. Even though the Vlad might be kasher, would be a mamzer, it would still be forbidden. So Moshe says, he's assuming that the reason this is true is not because the child would be a mamzer. Rather, the only reason this would be prohibited is because, avam mikevan shatam mifurasham shehu midin gzera shema yisa achoto me'aviv. What is the concern here? It's the concern of hafchana. We're concerned that in such a situation, maybe the child will end up marrying his sister or her sister or her brother. Right? That's what we're really concerned with. You're not going to know your true parentage. That's why. That's the only reason why this case of the sheet or the case of IUI would be potentially problematic from a donor, because we don't necessarily know who the father is.
I mean, that actually could happen, because there are some people who are like multiple sperm donors. They do it on a regular basis because they think they help.
Yeah, there are.
People have children, but if, you know, especially if you're in a smaller city or town, you could end up having your child marry their brother or sister.
Yeah, I mean, I think they say, like, Genghis Khan was, like, responsible for, like, the entire population of Mongolia or something.
Yeah.
Plus they're getting paid for it.
Thousands of
children. Yeah. Well, those getting paid for. Yeah, but it's also true. I mean, like, you want to watch, like, I think there's, like, at least 100 movies or TV shows that, like, have some plot line of finding out if your kid or whatever or something later. It's a very common Hollywood plot line. So certainly it's possible. And so Moshe says that's the only concern. And so since it's the only concern, Moshe is going to have a kula that comes out of this.
Right, so you can.
It's worth pointing out not everyone agrees with him. Some people think, no, it's not just that it's a concern of Havchana, which is an Iser Derabanan of, you know, maybe at a later point they'll get married. Maybe the concern is there's actual mamzerut here. This relationship, this even IUI, would actually lead to a mom there, which would be a lot more serious.
If it was a woman who wasn't married, which you alluded to before, that there'd be no moms or problem. She's not married.
It's
only for if a woman whose husband doesn't...
Only if she's married, and she's using a donor, But, so either way, Sir Moshe continues a little bit, and he says, I'm reading a little bit, So therefore, because of all this, Yesh l'hatir v'zera shel nachri, shekeven shavlad yisrael, kevan shimo yisraelit, ein lachush laklum, de'ein lo yichus la'aba nachri, af im haya derech bia, v'kol shekein, kishen derech bia, elem b'ambati. So Moshe therefore suggests, what should you do to solve this issue of Avchana? You should get a non-Jewish sperm donor. You should get a donor who isn't Jewish. Why is that good? Why is that a better solution? Because the product of a relationship between a non-Jew, Jewish man, and a Jewish woman is that the child is Jewish, and the child is not considered to be related, actually, to his biological father, right? Because a non-Jewish man, halachically, is not considered to be related to his child, his progeny. And so this child would actually have no relationship to his father, in which case there's no concern of having a sister, right? There's no concern.
Yeah, if that guy had a daughter through the same means with somebody else,
it wouldn't be a problem. Exactly. And that's why Rav Moshe suggests to use a non-Jew. I'm going to skip that line. It doesn't really matter for us. I'm going to skip that line also. I'm going to keep skipping a little bit because it's tight issues. V'gam yo'il. So he quotes the other, even positions who think that there might be a mamzer issue here. This would certainly help with all those problems, because being with a non-Jew is not considered to be a mamzer. And then even if a woman cheats on her husband and sleeps with a non-Jew, it's certainly forbidden, but it's actually not considered to be a child. It's not a mamzer.
I did not know that.
If you have a non-Jewish donor, and he has a daughter separately, under American law, wouldn't it be incest if the daughter and the son of the donor, of the Jewish woman, were together?
I actually don't know American law. Would it be incest?
If they knew, then...
No, but they don't know, but that's...
So if you're talking about what's the definition of incest, that would be incest.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know technically American law, whether there's, like, a requirement. Yeah, like, I don't know what would happen. Like, would you have to find out, or do you have to, like, I don't know.
I don't think they make you find out, but if you did find out, and you knew that the woman you were engaged to was your sister, you could get married to her.
So I'm saying you'd be violating a crime.
Well,
in American law.
It's against the law. I don't know if they put you in jail for incest. Maybe they might. They probably wouldn't if it's a brother.
I don't know.
Usually it's when a father rapes his daughter.
I think there's a general assumption, especially in halacha, that all these cases of chana cases are cases we don't know. Because it's kind of an assumption that this is 90%+ of people, 99% of people, if you know this person is your relative, like, you're not going to want to have a child with them. That's just like, it's almost like a very natural, like, repulsion. For most people, it's the human instinct. So it's, so usually the case here is we don't know. And that's why it would be better to have with the non-Jew. L'chein yish lahakir b'shat l'tachak gadol u'mistari me'or b'shtokim l'vlad mizrok li'isha v'me'er l'zera shanachri davka. And that's why in a case of Shas Hadchak, if you have no other choice and they're very much they want to have a child, you should allow them to use IUI or IVF from a non-Jewish sperm donor. Umistaver, she'af stam zera, yesh tiglo shil shonachar. So here Moshe deals with another question, which is, what if you don't really know who the donor is? I mean, you go to the sperm bank, and the sperm bank, you know, sometimes they'll tell you some of the attributes of like, oh, this person, you know, had the following things. But even then, they probably will not say, oh, the person was Jewish or not Jewish. I mean, they might, but they might not. Especially if the person is like not a self-identifying Jew, you know, especially if they're not religious. So Ramosha's question is, do I need to be concerned that maybe the sperm donor was Jewish? So Ramosha says, no, you don't have to be concerned about that. Some people do think you need to be concerned by it. Ramosha says, you do not need to be concerned by it. Why not? Because, number one, the large, large majority of people in this country are not Jewish. And therefore, just statistically, presumably the large majority of sperm donations are also not Jewish.
That might not be so in New York, or especially in
Massachusetts. Although he seems to assume so even in New York. Yeah. Not only that, he says, of the Jewish population, only those who are not religious are going to be the ones who are donating sperm to the sperm bank. And that basically even you're making the pool even smaller. And not only that, he doesn't really fully say this, but there might be some other logic arguments about one point you're not religious, like maybe for some people, not a very common position, but some people are not even considered to be Jewish, so there's a lot of arguments to be saying there's no issue here. And that's why you can use this rove, you can use this big rove, this big probability that indeed the sperm donor, if you don't know, is probably not Jewish and therefore not an issue. But of course, if you can find out, it is better to find out. I will say that while all this is nice and good about using IUI or IVF from non-Jewish donors, it's a little bit trickier because most people who want to have children through IUI or from a sperm donor usually want their child to look like them. And depending on your donor, they might not necessarily look like you. They
even
might,
if they're Jewish, they may not look like you.
Right. But especially I'm saying if they're not Jewish, they might be from a different race. They might, you know, have very different facial features. Your whole family is, you know, black-haired, and you have a blonde-haired child.
Well, they probably keep track of the race with sperm.
But you don't necessarily always have so much. But there's like a lot of different possibilities, and so for that reason, though, people psychologically much prefer, you know, what the best sperm donor would be to use, you know, a sibling or something, or use a family member, or use someone who's close by, because that way I solve the issue. They look exactly like me. Right, or let's say the husband can't have a child, right? Let's say in this case, it's a case where the couple is married, and the husband, you know, is not, is infertile, he can't have a child. But he still wants the child that his wife's going to have to look like him. He doesn't want every single person in the world to know that he didn't have the child. So, and some people prefer to use, like, a sibling or something. So Rav Moshe is saying that's actually the worst thing you could do because of these issues. Better use a non-Jew, but it, you know, it's actually a lot harder to do it in terms of pastorally, emotionally.
Have sex with your brother's wife.
Well, you wouldn't.
Speaking unless it's a Yibum situation.
Well, you're not having.
I know it's not
right.
Sex, but that could be an additional factor.
Yeah, I mean, you're not having sex, but yeah, but certainly I think there's like part of this question is not just, you know, what's best logically, but also pastorally, like what do people want? And it's a little bit more complicated. Actually, to that end, I'll mention this last tumor of Moshe discusses this, where he makes the following point, which is, I think, really interesting and important from a pastoral perspective. He says, source number three, this is a tshuva written much later, I don't remember the date, Hinei mashi katavti b'tshuva b'chelek aleph, says any other tshuva, so the tshuva that we've just read previously, skulam emet ubaru ladina, so I still believe in all of them, they still are true, I have not changed my opinion, Moshe esne tarik mehem, I have not changed, I have not, you know, I don't doubt myself, v'leka shum chashashot v'zrika zera shal machrim, and there is no concerns with a sperm donation from non-Jews. Aval lemaase lo horeti lasot kein mitam shel inyan kiyum mitzva privyevya lebala ein ze klum. So in practice, though, I do not recommend this thing to be done. I don't recommend couples to use a a non-Jewish sperm donor in practice. Why not? Because, number one, on a technical level, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah peruvu. Because the husband, well, he can't have children, and this isn't his child. So he didn't fulfill the mitzvah peruvu.
That's the same now as Jewish or not Jewish.
Yeah, it wouldn't make a difference.
That would complicate our adoption issue.
Yeah, it would complicate it. But Rav Moshe kind of is playing both sides. Because earlier he had said, like, oh, isn't peruvu about raising children? Rav Moshe himself seems to think it's more than just raising children. It also requires a bit more. So Rav Moshe is saying, in this case, like, you're definitely not fulfilling peruvu. Not everyone would agree. Minchat Chinuch might actually say, no, you do fulfill peruvu. But Rav Moshe thinks you're not fulfilling peruvu. V'ha'isha not ha'ena mechuyevet. And women, in general, are also not chayav technically in peruvu. So there's no, you know, chiyuv that she's fulfilling. V'shayach sheyetei mizeh kina gdola lebala, v'lachein ein zeh itza tova. And what's the detriment? So on the one hand, the positive is this couple is going to have a child to raise, and maybe the woman really desperately wants a child, or maybe they both really want a child. The negative, though, is that you're not fulfilling mitzvah peruvu anyways, and this can lead potentially to a lot of discord in a marriage, right? The husband might end up becoming jealous and might be very upset, you know, because it's not his child, and maybe the child at some point is going to find out, oh, you're not my real father. It could create some certain marital discord. So Moshe says he doesn't really encourage it in practice. I mean,
with the two women.
Yeah, in general, to use, you know, a sperm donor, especially in a married, you know, a married couple, to use someone else's donation. Now, in practice, like, I think it's going to be a case-by-case basis. You're going to have to, you know, deal with the couple. But I think certainly it's true that anyone who is going to use this type of method, because unfortunately they're in this reality, I think it's important to be aware of, like, these are the challenges you're going to face. You're going to have this problem. And there is, you know, a real concern that at some point, you know, the father might feel, you know, they're not related. And the same thing's true in the reverse case of surrogacy. You know, if the woman feels, you know, inadequate, this isn't really my child, and it does create potential problems. So Rav Moshe, you know, saying I don't recommend it, does he mean it's forbidding it? No, but it's just worth being aware that there are the potential pastoral concerns, you know, emotional concerns that might come out of these issues. One thing that I didn't quote here was the question of being a Kohen. So Rav Moshe, in terms of Kohen, if it comes from the father, then Rav Moshe seems to be pretty explicit, you would be a Kohen. But if the father is not Jewish, then of course the person is not a Kohen. Not only that, but if the father is not Jewish, then there is a separate concern of what about, let's say the person has a daughter. So the daughter of a relationship between a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman is actually not permitted to marry a Kohen. It's one of those laws people don't always know about. It's, yeah, you're not allowed to marry a Kohen if you are the product of a illicit relationship of that sort. So the question is raised, what if you are the product of, you know, you have to say you're a daughter who's born from a, you know, a sperm donation from a non-Jewish man. So Rav Moshe says, because there was no actual sexual act, this woman, this, you know, this product, the child here, the woman, the daughter, can indeed marry a Kohen. There's no problem on her yichus. She can marry a Kohen. Right? She's not considered to herself be a Kohen, or if it was a boy, he wouldn't be considered to be a Kohen because her father, you know, is not a Kohen, but the woman would be allowed to indeed marry a Kohen. So, you know, there are a lot of really interesting and important, you know, questions that emerge out of this, and all of this only that was IUI and IVF, when you get to surrogacy, it becomes even more complicated. Because surrogacy, it's not just about the man, it's also about the woman. And, you know, how do we relate to the surrogate mother? How do we relate to the birth, to the, you know, to the birth mother, to the...
There was a big machlokas with the time surrogacy started as to whether the mother was the one who gave birth or the mother was the one who's genetically the mother.
Yeah. And so there are also questions that emerge then, okay, so what's better in terms of, is it better than have a Jewish surrogate or a non-Jewish surrogate? These questions become very complicated, because if it's a non-Jewish surrogate, so then you might need to have conversion. On the other hand, if it's a Jewish surrogate, then maybe you have a problem of avchana, if the child is there to be related to this mother, and then, you know, you have this,
well,
this issue that complicates.
If you had a non-Jewish surrogate, the father was a Kohen, and you'd have to have conversion, and this child wouldn't be a
Kohen. Yeah.
Whereas if you have a Jewish surrogate, the child would be a Kohen.
There are all sorts of issues that emerge from this, so it's, you know, a lot more complicated. I don't think Rav Moshe actually deals with surrogacy anywhere. I must be wrong.
I don't know if they had it.
I don't think they had it back then. Yeah. But, yeah.
I can tell you from personal experience with my son, it was actually 8 years ago today that they had a daughter, and she died 5 days later. and then they had a,
yeah,
he died 5 days later, and then they had a boy, which was sort of a miracle, but they wanted another one, and they went through all types of things, and they did IVF, but they had to use a surrogate, and they went to Georgia. The country,
yeah,
right,
former Soviet Union, yeah.
Which is where a whole slew of Israelis go for surrogacy. And one of the things was, you know, that you use somebody non-Jewish, and she has to go through a conversion process, and it's a whole big deal. They had to spend 6 or 8 weeks after the birth in Georgia in order to get a passport, you know, to get a birth certificate.
Right.
And they still don't have American, she still doesn't have American citizenship. Because that, you know, it's also a thing with DNA, which gets sent to one place to another and verification.
Right.
So it's a very big...
yeah. Certainly, you know, this the whole process is, A, it's difficult for the parents, you know, involved here, because they, I don't think would prefer to have a child the normal way, the easy way, certainly emotionally difficult, and you're right, absolutely, there are lots of questions that come up, legal questions, and yeah, this is very difficult. Fortunately, we do have, it's better to have the option of surrogacy than not to have it at all, but it does create all these questions, and, they're not just moral, they're not just ethical, interesting legal questions, they are real emotional, they affect real people, and yeah, absolutely. And
I published an article a year